Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively getting you ready for the election, perhaps the aftermath of the election. We've talked so much about it. Before we do that, I want to give some thanks to all of our sponsors in making this merger from WNST.net and sports for a quarter of a century. To doing what we're doing now, which is Baltimore Positive, which includes all of our great sports coverage, including Luke Jones during Steelers week and beyond for Ravens fans, Orioles fans, and Terps fans alike, but also having these really important conversations you're seeing us have out on social media. All of it brought to you by our friends at Taharka. They have a new flavor. It's called Black is Beautiful. It's so new, I don't have a carton of it, but I will have one by next week. It is the Chocolate Stout together with the Monumental Brewing Company. This year's the Mint Flix. Good. Peppermint Bark's going to be better during the holiday season, and if you are a Taharka fan and a Baltimore Positive fan, we're going to have an offer for you during the holidays to save some money, and like the Moeller family, because I've been over there for the holidays back before we all had to wear masks, eat pretty well during the holidays as well with our friends at Taharka. Speaking of eating well, I got my El Guapo shirt on here. Catonsville's now open with great Latin food over there. I had the quesadillas, the margaritas. Get on over there with the carnitas. And across the street, of course, State Fair, where I'm going to be having the chicken and waffles this weekend, hopefully amidst some sunny conditions. Right next door to where Fadley's is bringing those crab cakes from downtown out to Catonsville. They're working it all through, hopefully open early next year. But you can order those Fadley crab cakes, and you can ship them anywhere in the world. Don Moeller, the last time we got together with this guy, we would have said, hey, John, Congressman, we're going to have a plague in a year, year and a half. Enjoy that crab cake, buddy.
I think we were having crab cakes, having a good time in what we thought was a fairly normal situation. That was then. This is now.
No crab cakes for you, Congressman.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Don, and thank you, Nestor. And I enjoy being on Baltimore Positive. I was looking outside, though, a few minutes ago to see if you had delivered a crab cake to me. So I want you to know I was disappointed that I did not see that.
You know what I've learned, though? If I start delivering ice cream, you have to be there to take receipt. That's what they've taught me here, being an ice cream sponsor. We don't deliver the ice cream unless you're there on the porch. So there's not like an Amazon package.
I always love the story that you tell, Congressman. You told the last time you were here, maybe some of our listeners didn't catch that episode, about when your brother-in-law comes to town. You know he's missed you guys, but he doesn't come directly to your house.
No, he goes straight to Thaley's and in Lexington Market. That's the route he takes to our house. I don't even know. Maybe he may come up here sometimes and not even call us. He may come from Texas, just pick up a few crab cakes and get back on the road.
Fly back on Southwest. Does he at least bring you a couple of crab cakes, or are they gone by the time he gets to the house?
No, we get something, but it's a leftover. Let me put it.
Well, you can ship them to him, one click away on the website, so he can have a very happy holiday. Congressman, we've left you alone, and I think the last time I saw you was at the Baltimore Homecoming right around this time last year. It was the second week of October. I think we hit the buffet. We had a few words and your staff, and it was a wonderful event. So much has changed, and we haven't had you on since the beginning of March. Can you just run us through what for your life and where you were at the beginning of all of this, and sort of understanding the depths of all of this and when that came about for you?
Yeah, I mean, so many changes, so much upheaval. Obviously, everybody's going through it. I'm in my basement. Those are cinder blocks behind me. Right. I used to. I got my backdrop curated a little bit better, but in the early days, people were referring to my video as the "He's Alive" video.
You weren't getting highly rated on Room Raider, is that what you're saying?
it looks a little bit like Churchill's bunker. I remember from what I saw in London.
It was definitely looked like a hostage situation, but I've improved the backdrop a little bit. But look, we're all having to get used to doing things differently. And we're sort of wondering what's it going to look like on the other side of this pandemic in terms of how we operate. I mean, I think one thing that's clear is that we're learning that there's some things you cannot substitute real-time interaction with. I mean, that being in the same physical space with others makes a huge difference for certain kinds of things. But we're also learning, frankly, there's a lot of stuff you can do remotely that's more efficient. So it'll be very interesting to see how that all kind of lands, how we kind of distribute our time and what makes sense and how we view value going forward in our work, in our personal interactions, all that kind of stuff. So that's one piece of it. And we're all dealing with that. Everybody's trying to wrestle with this current reality, which is hopefully not a new permanent reality, but is something that we're wading through at this point. Then in terms of doing my job in particular, just representing, 720,000 Marylanders, the premium is on being a trusted source of advice and guidance for people and good information, particularly right now in the midst of this election, because there's so much disinformation out there. Some of it's organic. It's just a result of the confusion that's come about because of having to change up a lot of the way we do things around elections. But some of it's more insidious than that. It's, cynical political operatives or the Russians or whoever it might be trying to get in here and mess around with our business in terms of how our democracy functions and how we have elections. So making sure that we are there for people to help guide them through this difficult time is the number one priority in terms of constituent service. And then also, obviously, working every day to try to get some relief out of Washington, assistance to people across the country and in Maryland and in the 3rd District, whether it's unemployment insurance, whether it's stimulus checks, nutrition assistance, mortgage and rental assistance, the list goes on and on, assistance for those frontline healthcare workers. So that's what we're doing right now. But the most important thing is to be there for each other, to kind of link arms in the midst of this storm. And there are many storms going on right now. Get through it, get to the other side, get to a place where we feel like, to be honest, there is a plan for how the country's dealing with the pandemic. And we've put real economic assistance out there for people to help them through this difficult time. But look, it's a new reality, Don, and we've got to deal with it.
Well, as you mentioned, the whole point of information and the role that so many of you are trying to play, as we record this, I call this Brooks Robinson Day. There are 5 days to go until November 3rd when we sit down to record this. And as I walked in here, I took a break between our last recording and this one, and I saw Trump's communications director, campaign communications director, being interviewed, and he was being asked very directly about a statement that the White House issued yesterday, not the campaign, the official White House issued a press release that said one of the major accomplishments of the Trump administration was its defeat of the pandemic. And that came out on a day when we've hit 80,000 new cases, the highest ever. And when asked about that statement, he said, well, the White House has already issued a clarification that that may have been poorly worded. It may have been poorly worded. I'm not sure. Nestor had said earlier, Congressman, to one of our guests, it's not that we don't have enough information anymore. It's that we're being flooded with disinformation.
The president is living in an alternative reality, and it just gets worse with each passing day. He's in complete denial of the failures of his administration, and that's why there almost seems to be a relationship with, on the one hand, as things get worse, he doubles down on this rhetoric that we've turned the corner, that we're crushing the virus.
Well, it looks like the people of Wisconsin realize he's lying to them as their hospitals and their,
I think this is like, this is sort of the whole point right now, is that the choice is so clear for the American people in this election. Do you want someone who is connected to reality, is going to tell you the truth, be straight with you, is going to have a plan? Not that overnight we're going to fix this. Nobody thinks that. But we have a choice between a president that's in denial, that tries to divide America, that exhibits a meanness every day just by impulse, That's one choice. On the other hand, we have someone of decency and character who's willing to tell people the truth, who understands we need to put together a plan. And frankly, you know, we had a lot of great candidates running on the Democratic side. And, you know, any one of them, I think, would have been a great president. The thing about Joe Biden is I'm not sure anyone has the combination of empathy and experience that he does. He's had pain in his life. We all know about it. But he's taken that and he's used it to connect to people out there in the country who are feeling pain. And I've been quoting a lot a phrase that Ayanna Pressley, who's one of the new members of Congress from Massachusetts, uses. And she says, the people who are closest to the pain should be closest to the power. And I think that what Biden's going to do is he's going to pull the people in this country who are in pain close to him, and he's going to make policy that's designed to help them deal with that pain and get through this tough time. That's the way he's going to lead, and that's what we need at this moment. We need someone with that kind of empathy and that kind of experience. So if you got that choice on one part of the ballot, and you got this Trump guy somewhere else on the ballot, to me, it's very clear what the American people need to do. And I'm hopeful, Don, because the data coming back is suggesting all kinds of things. First of all, almost 70 million Americans have voted. We're at October 29th. We're over 50% of what the turnout was in the 2016 election. So people are taking it seriously. Secondly, young people are coming out, we think, at levels we've never seen in recent memory. So they're taking it seriously. They've connected the dots. They understand all the stuff they care about, whether it's racial injustice or it's climate change or it's gun safety, that connects to who runs the show. So they're coming out. Also, as of 3 or 4 days ago, the numbers must be higher now, but I saw a statistic that 2 million people, Democrats, who stayed home last time in 16, have already voted in this election. So people who understand they made a mistake by sitting out the last election, they're not making that mistake this time. So the signs are hopeful that America is going to fire this president. And, you know, during the Democratic convention, I was saying to our delegates that, you know,
that was the one that wasn't on the White House lawn, right? That was
not, it was not. No,
that was the other one. I'm just making sure.
but, you know, if Trump wins another term, then he leaves because he's term limited. So right now we have the opportunity to actually fire him. Like, this is the opportunity to fire this guy. And I hope that that's the decision that people make next week. And then this guy can sort of walk off, you know.
Well, we're going to use that.
Do you think he'll walk off, by the way? There's been a lot of conjecture about that. How do you think this goes? Because I promise you, I've seen the movie. It was called Wag the Dog. At about 10 o'clock on Tuesday night, he's going to declare victory, right?
Let's see what happens. I mean, you know, there are states that are counting their votes now that are consequential, Arizona, Florida, and so forth. So they're going to be in a position, even with a lot of the mail-ins, to point to, you know, significant tally early. Early meaning these days on election night versus sort of 3, 4, 5 days after that. So let's see how that plays out. I think, you know, we could know relatively quickly the results of this election. And if the result is that Donald Trump has lost the election, the good news is that across the country, state and local election officials are, for the most part, professionals. They want to do the right thing. They don't want an election that's tainted. They're going to be doing their best to try to deliver the outcome in a responsible way. And then what happens is, you know, there's something kind of inexorable about how the certification of results works. Once those things start coming in, it gets very tough for a candidate to overturn that outcome. So I'm...
Well, we hope, as American citizens, I hope you're right, right?
Look, fundamentally, I don't think this guy, at the end of the day, has the courage to fight clear results. I think if that writing is on the wall, first of all, a lot of the people that are huffing and puffing around him, I mean the people that work for him, they're going to start looking for the exits because they'll understand the reality. Now, whether there's a certain core group of the president's followers out there in the country that will refuse to accept the results and want to cause some trouble, yeah, that could happen. But I'm pretty confident that we can land in a decent place relatively soon. And we have to, I mean, one of the things we've been working on with the public and with the press and everything is to say to them, you know, count to 10. We don't need to know the results at 8:01 p.m. on election night. If it takes 2 or 3 days here or 4 or 5 days somewhere else, that doesn't mean there's something insidious or there's chicanery going on. That's just the process playing itself out. Everybody needs to be patient, get the votes counted. We got a couple of good, as it happens, Supreme Court decisions in the last 48 hours, which are going to make it more possible in certain key places like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and so forth for those mail-in ballots to be counted. So I think we're going to, let me put it this way. There's that great story about Benjamin Franklin leaving the Constitutional Convention, right, in Philadelphia. And this woman, Mrs. Powell, comes up to him. Everyone's telling this story, but it's important. And she says to him, Dr. Franklin, what do we have, a monarchy or a republic? And he looks her in the eye and he says, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. And I very much feel like this is the if you can keep it moment in American history. Like this is the moment that Ben Franklin abstractly was imagining where the American people would have to step up and show that they want to keep it. They want to keep this republic. And I'm cautiously optimistic that that's what's happening right now, that across the country, people are saying, you know what, we're going to pull this republic back from the precipice where it's been dangling for the last 4 years. And we're going to turn, face that rising sun and march towards a better future. And you need the people to do it because, we tried to get rid of this guy other ways, right? We had an impeachment proceeding. Unfortunately, we had a corrupt jury on the Senate side with a corrupt jury foreman named Mitch McConnell. So it wasn't going to happen. But when that was going down, I was saying, look, let's just impanel a new jury of 130 or 40 million Americans and let them render the verdict. That's what's happening right now. And I think that verdict is we want to keep this republic. We want to build it, make it stronger. And in that sense, this is not just the election we've been waiting for 4 years. It may be the election our country's been waiting for almost 250 years because it's the election that tests who we are, the resiliency of our democracy. And if we can show it's resilient, then we can build it back from there. And that's not going to be easy, because a lot of damage has been done, but it's who we are as Americans. I think if we have the right kind of leadership that is a call to arms, that it's an appeal to our best angels, to us as patriots, as Americans, to stand up, get us through this tough time, and then build the country back better, as Biden likes to say, I think we're up to the challenge. We just need the right leadership.
Well, let's assume. I love the optimistic tone, Congressman. So I want to build on that. And again, if you're just tuning in, we're with 3rd District Congressman John Sarbanes from Maryland, giving us a little light at the end of the tunnel, talking about preserving our republic. Assume that we do, and let's take another little dose of optimism. Assume that Democrats can take control of the Senate, because even should Joe Biden win, if Democrats come up short on the Senate, you may disagree, but I think most of us think Congress just grounds to a halt again, because as you mentioned, Mitch McConnell has shown no inclination to wanting to govern. You have what I think unabashedly, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, I think it's one of the most important pieces of legislation to have been introduced in the last 15 or 20 years. The speaker thought it was important enough to name it HR1, and it passed overwhelmingly in March of 2019, the House of Representatives, and it is sitting in a drawer on Mitch McConnell's desk. I'm assuming a Democratic Senate cannot wait to take it up. So we want to give you an opportunity. We touched on it when you were here before, but I don't think in enough detail. Walk our listeners through what HR1 is and why it's so darn important.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, HR1 has been kind of my life's work since I've been in Congress. I've been working on these reform issues for many, many years. And last year, we were able to assemble what we think is kind of the big bang package of democracy reform, which is designed to fight this corruption in Washington that people feel strongly about, and fix our democratic institutions so they actually represent the will of the people. And, you know, it's a big bill, Don, but you can distill it down to responding to three basic grievances that we hear from the American people over and over and over again. The first one is, just let me get to the ballot box without having to run an obstacle course. Like, why is it that every 2 years we got to have all these problems with voting in America? There's got to be a better way. And so for that, we've got all kinds of provisions in this bill that address voter suppression across the country, but also big structural changes that just make it easier and more convenient, and by the way, safer in a pandemic, to register and vote. So for example, automatic voter registration. If you put that in place across the country, and Americans of all political stripes think it makes sense when you poll them, when you complete that of having automatic AVR, automatic voter registration in every state in America, you will have added 50 million people, 50 million people, to the voting rolls in America. Then same day registration, no excuse absentee ballot registration, a certain minimum number of days of early voting, all the things that is saying to the voter, you're actually important, we want you to vote, we want to make it easy for you to vote, and we're going to create a system that does that.
So they are assuming everybody's paying taxes, right? So, you know, for that reason, you'd think if they could find me on tax day, they could find me to allow me to vote, right?
Well, how does that work? Nestor, I actually like that question in this sense.
Well, everybody has a passport. Not everybody has a driver's license. Well, you know, like, what does everybody have, right?
Well, that's why I want to turn to the congressman. I don't know if your bill gets down to the specifics of that beyond the philosophy, but in your world, or that you can explain it to her, how does automatic voter registration work?
The way it works, and you know this, Don, because you've been in local government, there's all kinds of interactions that government or quasi-government agencies have with the public where they collect a certain amount of information in that process. It can be when you go to get your license. It can be when you go to a social services agency. There's all kinds of things. So what automatic voter registration does is every time you have that kind of contact where you're giving the same amount of information to that agency that would be needed to register you to vote, it automatically will register you, give you the option if you want to opt out of that. So that's very clearly offered. But the default is, we've got your information, we can sign you up. You're now registered to vote.
Like, John, would this not help with census and stuff too? I mean, I'm trying to get a little bit more modern from the way we did this in 1942, right? Like, it's 2020. I'm trying to think about how they're going to do this in 2035, and it ain't going to be with a postage stamp, right? Like, literally.
Well, and you saw in this year's census, a lot more was done online in terms of people filling out the questionnaire. We've had some challenges with the census, but we're trying to push through on that. Again, those challenges came from this administration that for some reason doesn't want everybody to be counted. But there's a lot of things that we can modernize here to just make it easier for people to get their voice heard, whether it's being counted in the census, which happens every 10 years, or whether it's the ability to vote, which happens every 2 years, or even more frequently than that when you add in local elections and so forth. So we want to modernize this and make it easier for people. So that's a big part of HR 1, Don. Secondly, we have in there a provision to deal with partisan gerrymandering across America because people
Your district, you know a little bit about that.
Dude, I'm looking at your district again, and I know we had at this a year ago, but I mean, how is this even allowed in America, John? I mean, I'm seriously.
Well, in fairness, Maryland is a strange-shaped state to begin with. Then you have the Chesapeake
Bay. Ain't that strange? I'm looking at it.
Then you have the Chesapeake Bay running through it. And then you throw a little politics in for sure, and you can end up with some strange-looking districts. But to be honest, in Maryland, while we have strange-looking districts, our state isn't a classic case of extreme partisan gerrymandering. Because we are a Democratic state, we end up with, you know, on balance, it nets out for Democrats in terms of members of Congress. So there's some connectivity there to reality. But you can go to other states around the country where the Democrats, for example, have a majority of the registered voters in that state. But because of the way the lines have been drawn in this kind of very partisan way, the delegation ends up leaning, you know, 60-70% to the Republican side. So we need to make it so that the maps are more fair, they're more representative, they're more respectful of the people. And a lot of folks are angry at this idea that the politicians pick the voters instead of the other way around. That's kind of the shorthand way of talking about this. So we've got provisions in HR 1 that would create a more objective, independent standard for drawing these congressional districts across the country in every state, because you got to fix it everywhere or you're still going to have a lot of politics in the mix. So that's an important piece.
Well, stay on that one before you leave, before you go to three. Stay on that one for a second, Congressman. And we are with Congressman John Sarbanes, 3rd District of Maryland. It's funny. I just got beat up last night in a back and forth on social media with one of my former students who wanted to basically say, you know, all you dumb Democrats, you gerrymander this. And my answer was yours, that Democrats are absolutely for addressing gerrymandering, but they recognize it needs a federal solution. It can't be state by state so that it has some equity. The other thing, and I know you've seen all of the numbers, correct me if I'm wrong before you go to number three. I think the same is true with the idea of universal voting, but I know on gerrymandering, that polls off the charts in a bipartisan fashion, right? Fixing that.
Yeah, let me just say this. Everything I'm going to tell you that's in HR 1 polls at 75% and up in the country. This is not a, you know, Mitch McConnell wants to call it a Democratic power grab. It's not a Democratic power grab. It's a power grab by the people of the country who just are like, let us back in. That's all we're asking. So that's what all of this is about. It's just respect for the average person out there who's fed up and feel like they have been kind of pushed to the margins of their own democracy, which is largely true if you look what's happened over the last few years. So here are some other things that we do in there. We got to protect our election system against foreign interference. So we have a whole set of provisions there because we know we've seen the efforts in 16 and the Russians are back again in 20 and so forth to kind of hack into our election systems. We need the basic infrastructure of our elections to be strong. So that's like making sure there's paper ballot backup in all elections across the country, things like that. So that's just kind of preserving the strength and integrity of how the mechanics of our elections operate. but also like guidelines for digital platforms on making sure there's more transparency on who's spending money on political ads on those platforms. You know how we do with television, you have to stand up at the end of an ad and say, you know, I approve this ad, this statement or whatever.
I'm John Sarbanes and I approve this message.
Approve this message. We need a similar kind of sort of disclaimer or stand by your ad standard in terms of digital platform ads so that people know where this is coming from and you can't kind of hide those sorts of things. So we have that in place. The next thing is that we hear from people, again, pretty basic, is they say to us, when you go to Washington, behave yourselves. Like, why is that so hard? Be ethical, be accountable, be transparent, respect us, act right. So we have a whole set of reforms in there that goes straight to that question, like address conflicts of interest, put code of ethics in place, not just for the White House and the executive branch, but for members of Congress, for the judiciary, the Supreme
Court. You mean things like selling off stock before a plague, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly right. So people just want us to be honest when we get there. And look, you know, the average person starts out pretty cynical about that anyway. They think oftentimes everyone's a scoundrel who's in politics. So it's a heavy lift. But there's things we could do to improve there. And we've obviously seen in this administration, we have a president. He wasn't even inaugurated yet, Don. He hadn't even taken office. And he's making statements that say, a president of the United States can't have a conflict of interest. So he's sending a message to everybody he's going to hire and all the kind of political rank and file around him. Hey, if you want to step over the boundaries of ethics, go right ahead, because I'm going to be your number one cheerleader on this. He's demonstrated an ethical blindness of kind of epic proportions over the last 4 years. So we got to fix that. And then the last thing we hear from people, and we tried to design a real response to that, is when you get to Washington, don't get tangled up in the money. Remember who sent you there. Continue to represent our interests. And this comes from people having seen over and over again that politicians get to Washington, they get captured by the big money and the special interests. And before you know it, they're carrying out their agenda instead of carrying out the agenda of the American people. And people are just fed up with that. They want us to fix that. So we have provisions to create more disclosure of where this dark money's coming from. We stand up a system of small donor matching to fund congressional campaigns, like what Baltimore County, by the way, is trying to achieve right now, and other jurisdictions across Maryland have done and across the country. What does that do? It lets the people feel like, hey, we own this system and it will answer to us. It will be a government, like James Madison said, that's dependent upon the people alone, not on the big money and the special interests. But here's the other thing it does. And we've seen this at the state and local level. Why not have it at the federal level too? It allows different kinds of candidates to run and be successful, because you don't have to know people with a lot of money and deep pockets in order to be competitive as a candidate. If you collect small donations, you get matching funds, you can actually run a pretty good campaign and you can compete and you can win. And we've seen that at the state and local level across the country. We want to do that for Congress too, because we want to bring a broad, diverse set of candidates to Washington to represent the voice of the people. So that's it. Let us get to the ballot box. Clean up your act in Washington. Don't get taken hostage by the money. Remember where you came from. That's HR 1. And here's what we're going to do. If we get this trifecta, and that's what we're hoping for, and Democrats have the opportunity to do some things quickly, we want to move as fast as we can with this. My mantra is, keep it together, keep it strong, and keep it moving. And the other thing I say is, we did the dress rehearsal last year in the House. We got it passed in the House because we had members of Congress who wanted to do it. They were committed and they delivered in the first 100 days. So what I say to people is, the HR 1 bag is packed. It's by the front door. If we get the trifecta, we got to grab it and go before McConnell and his zombie crowd try to take us down. So that's the agenda out of the gate. Now, obviously getting relief and assistance to the American people, which we've been working on for months now with the HEROES Act, that occupies its own territory of priority. That's the first thing. But leaving that aside, in terms of sequencing everything else, we believe this is the thing we come out of the gate with strong, get it to Joe Biden's desk, boom, big bang declaration that the democracy is back, it's strong, we respect the American people, and now let's go do all the other things that it'll be easier to accomplish if we're representing the will of the people and not the insider crowd.
But in order for that to happen, right, Congressman, this is where we get into the elections have consequences. In order to pick that bag up and get moving on that journey, as you talk about, let's get the bag delivered, is we need Democrats across the country to take back the Senate, because H.R. 1 is still dead upon arrival if Mitch McConnell is still president of the Senate, correct?
Now, I was going to throw in, too, John, early on you mentioned McConnell. You just mentioned him again. It's been about 10 minutes, and I almost stopped you at that point because you clearly have some angst. You know, I mean, I have some angst as a citizen, but, like, what would you tell me as a citizen about Mitch McConnell and about why this isn't happening?
Mitch McConnell has built a power structure over the last three decades that is dependent on suppressing the vote, hiding the ball in terms of how legislation gets made in Washington. In other words, deals made in the dead of night, behind the curtain, et cetera, and building up this power structure of big dark money influencers out there that just pour money into Washington. And so H.R. 1 in some ways goes directly at the heart of that. It would dismantle this cynical power structure that he's built over decades. And that's why he and all of his, you know, friends are going to fight like hell against this thing. It's another reason we can't stutter step, because he knows that if he can slow it down the way Washington works, it can get pushed off of the agenda because other things start to come in and so forth. So that's why we just got to boom, like, do not hesitate. And McConnell, look at what he just engineered with the Supreme Court. I mean, forget about putting someone on a court in an election year. He did it as people were casting their votes for a new president.
Yeah, millions of votes had already been cast.
Yeah, 60 million people had voted potentially in an election that's going to choose a new president at the moment she got confirmed the other night. I mean, talk about anti-democratic. I mean, that's, again, of epic proportions. But this is how he operates. The ends justifies the means. And that's why I think we got to come back fast if we get the opportunity and say, no, we're changing this system. We're going to go right at the heart of what you've built and build something different that respects the American people. Folks are here's – so the frustrating thing is you look at how disillusioned and cynical people have become across the country. So on the one hand, that can be depressing. But what's inspiring is that they're angry, and that means they still care. Like, they care enough about this democracy that they're getting angry at what they see instead of just getting defeated and completely demoralized and resigning themselves to it. So in that anger is the opportunity for a solution. But we got to give them a solution that makes sense and is restorative. What Trump did in 16, he found that anger of people who looked at Washington and felt disrespected. And he offered them a solution. His solution was to come to Washington, break furniture, and burn the place to the ground. And what we did, and if the story had ended there, it would have been pretty bleak. But in 18, what happened? A class of reform candidates from around the country ran in those same districts that Trump won in 16. And they said to that same angry part of the electorate, we know how you feel. We understand how disgusted you are with Washington and politics as usual. Here's our solution. Instead of going up there and burning it down, we're going to try to fix it so that your voice matters again. We're going to bring you back in and let you own your democracy again. And the good news is, those same voters sent that group to Washington, but it was a sacred bargain. Don't get there and forget what you told us and what you promised. So that class that came in, the class of reformers, they understood it was a promises made, promises kept bargain and delivered in the first 100 days. We got H.R. 1 onto the floor and passed by March 8th of 2019. If we get the trifecta, we're going to have even more House candidates coming off the trail who want to fight corruption. Every major Senate challenger who's running on the Democratic side has embraced this anti-corruption frame. And we'll have a president, frankly, who his whole career, I mean, going back to 1973, Joe Biden was calling for public financing of congressional campaigns in 1973 and talking about the undue influence of money back then. Look at where it's come now. So he's an ally as well on this. That's why we don't miss a beat. We grab it, we go, we deliver for the American people. And will that cure their cynicism overnight? No. Does it give us an opportunity, a path back to restoring some faith and trust in how American democracy functions and serves the people? Absolutely it does. That's why we can't miss this chance.
Well, Congressman, I love that optimism. I love H.R. 1. Before I get one final thought from you on the election, I do want, if people want to weigh in on H.R. 1, because I believe you and everything I've seen indicates it's true, over 70% of the people approve of everything in H.R. 1. It's very unusual. They approve of every aspect of it. Should they just simply email their congressman and say, get behind H.R. 1 now? Yeah, and their senators?
Absolutely. We want as much of the force behind this to come from the grassroots as possible. And, you know, starting the day after the election, if we get the good result, we want there to be a massive grassroots campaign of advocacy. There's a lot of groups that are ready to, you know, hit the go button on that. But having everyday Americans, average citizens out there who see in this bill a solution to a lot of the cynicism that they have right now, having them step up and send that message to the people that are going to vote on this legislation in Congress to make them understand this is a priority. It's not just something that got made up. This is real. That can make the difference. That always makes the difference, frankly, Don. So absolutely, any of your listeners, if what I've described about this big bang effort to fight corruption and fix our democracy, if that sounds like a good solution for our country as we move forward, setting the table for the things we want and the things we want to see, then definitely get in touch with your member of Congress and spread the word to anyone you know. Here's the challenge for us. When people hear H.R. 1 described, 75% of them and up say, absolutely, this is what we need. But a lot of people haven't heard of H.R. 1.
Right.
And that's what we gotta fix in the coming days and get that powerful collective voice behind it. We have a window of opportunity. We don't want to miss it.
That's why we wanted you on. Before we let you run, I know yes, you're an elected official and you're a policy guy, but like the rest of us, you're a political junkie. You're more, you know, you're tapped in. You've got colleagues, other House members all across the country in these swing states. We've got 5 days to go as we tape this. What kind of feedback and where is your optimism on a scale of 1 to 10 that Joe Biden is elected president in the next week or so? What are your colleagues across the country in those swing states telling you about their gut?
Well, I've been in touch over the last couple of months and certainly into these last few weeks with probably about 40 or 50 candidates that are running in House districts. Some of these are frontliners. These are people that were elected in 18 and they're in tough districts. They're trying to hold them. And then a lot are these amazing challengers. a lot of women candidates, by the way, Don. I mean, that I think, just to step back for a moment, we're going to look back on 16, 18, and 20 as being a transformational moment in American politics in terms of women coming into the political arena, not just as voters, not just as volunteers and activists, but as candidates, in a way that is changing our politics going forward. Of the 36 or 37, what they call red to blue candidates, which are candidates running in Republican districts that we're trying to flip to Democratic districts, of the 35 or 36, 29 of them are women candidates. And they came out of primaries where two or three other women candidates were running.
Well, this is probably the result right after the inauguration of the Pink Hats and Hillary. And there's been a tremendous empowerment here, right?
The number one recruiter for the Democratic Party has been Donald Trump in terms of candidate recruitment. Thank you. I mean, maybe it's the silver lining. What he has brought into our politics in terms of the people with amazing credentials and a desire to serve for all the right reasons is like nothing we've seen in recent memory. So I and what I'm hearing from them is, first of all, the voters will not be denied. They are going to get to the ballot box. And I'm often thinking of Martin Luther King's quote where he says, if you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. And if you can't walk, crawl. But whatever you do, keep moving. I feel like the voters out. I mean, I read today in the paper, some guy was worried about what happened with his mail-in ballot. So he got on a plane and flew 1,000 miles to Georgia to cast his ballot in person.
Wow.
People are not going to be denied in terms of getting their voice heard in this election. I think that bodes well for Democratic candidates and for the president. The other thing that I think is a plus factor for us is that there's a good feeling up and down the ballot that Joe Biden is meshing very well with candidates from all across our party. So there's this kind of consensus feeling among the Democrats, and I think it's bleeding over with independents and even to a lot of Republicans, that this is a good ticket. It's a sensible ticket. It's a rational ticket. It's people that are going to get up in the morning and, instead of making your blood pressure go up with an 8 a.m. tweet, will do some things so that by lunchtime you feel like, you know what, they're doing the best they can and they're helping me get through my day. Which is, my father, Don, always used to say that one thing that contributes immeasurably to people's quality of life is the sense of being well governed. If you get up in the morning and you've got it, you know, you got to get your kids to school, you got to get to work, you know, you got to get all these things done. If you just generally abstractly feel like the people in charge, they're not perfect, but they're doing their best and, you know, they're running things pretty well, that really helps you get through your day. It gives you some stability. Instead of the kind
of... Well, see, I spent time in Venezuela when the water was only on every 3 days.
Exactly.
Simple things, little things like that, you know.
Instead, we were all developing this kind of shaky hand syndrome because we got this guy in charge who, like I said, is spiking our blood pressure before we have breakfast. It's crazy. So, you know, I want to do big, bold things, but I also long for the day when our president, like, calls a press conference for 10 a.m., comes out and announces that, you know, we're going to make a 2.3% cost of living adjustment to Social Security for the coming year. Any questions? No. Have a good day. And goes back into the Oval Office. Like, just give me some of that for a while, right? Yeah.
People are exhausted. I couldn't agree more. I think people are exhausted. I'm going to believe, until it doesn't happen, that we're going to choose decency. And Nestor, I would tell you that anytime we have a segment that invokes the words of the great Senator Paul Sarbanes, that's been a good segment for me. So,
well, I would encourage everybody to go back into the archives and see Congressman Sarbanes talk about your dad coming out of Watergate when you were a kid. I remember those stories, and I hope somewhere there's a little Sarbanes or someone who's going to grow up to be a congressman for dad maybe 6 months from now, carrying some legal clipboards out the other side for all the sins that I hope are not pardoned you know, over the first 47 months or thereabouts, right?
Got it. Got it. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Congressman, HR1, everybody, look it up. Send your message. Make it go viral. HR1. Make it happen. Absolutely.
Congressman John Sarbanes joining us here. Appreciate you. Thank you.
Take care.
Crab cakes next time, and then we'll make sure the ice cream does not melt, all right?
Thank you, Congressman.
On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller and on behalf of all of our WNSD sponsors, we are WNSD.net, AM 1570, and merging in all the sports with our politics, with our news, and with everything that's Baltimore positive.